So Mondelez, I'll probably refer to it as craft throughout most of this presentation, I think. Thanks, Andy. So I probably couldn't have asked for a better introduction. Kathy did a great job of outlining where we are globally, essentially, in terms of obesity, overweight issues. What I want to talk about today is the first phase of actually a piece of a larger program that we've been working on for a while now. We pulled out the piece that's addressing sugar reduction. We're not going to talk about experimental design here, though, John, so we may come back to you for once we get through this and consider that. That away. Okay. So what I want to talk about today is the first phase of a program that we have looking at reducing sugar, and the work that we're going to talk about, we started to establish a baseline. We wanted to identify, and what I'm hoping we can do today is, as I go through the presentation, prompt some ideas for some discussion, and we certainly would welcome input. I think one of the key things I want to point out here, if you look, the objective is to that we set was to achieve a 25% reduction in added sugars. The main difference here is we've done work like this in the past. Probably first time I worked on sugar reduction projects was at General Foods back in the late 70s, early 80s. And through the years, I think within certainly the Kraft organization, we've developed some products. We have commercial products out there that are reduced in sugar or sugar-free. And they're good quality for what they are. The difference, though, I think, in what we're trying to do now is to meet the criteria I have on the bottom, which is to achieve quality comparable to control, good digestive tolerance in the bulking agents that we use, and an acceptable cost structure. I think that's what makes this such a challenge. And it's been mentioned in some of the previous presentations about the different functionalities that you get from sugar. In this talk, I'm going to focus on three model systems, two of the AACC cookie systems, and one is a soft cake system. This chart we put together to get at the functionalities that we're getting from the sugar, sweetness, flavor generation, moisture management, texture, bulking, color, shelf life. And it's our own internal ranking of how much contribution we're getting in each of the different systems. But it helps us as we start thinking about when we take out a percentage of sugar, we're going to need to put that bulk back in the bakery applications. What kind of attributes are you looking for? So these are some of the attributes that we put together. Not necessarily that we would need all of them in each ingredient, but you may need one or some combination. So solubility, and solubility could be you want something very soluble or you want something that's not too soluble. Physical and chemical stability, we need, obviously we need bake tolerance, heat tolerance. Humectant properties, viscosity, I have low viscosity here, but the reality is in some applications you may actually want to provide some viscosity. So viscosity, reduced caloric content. One of the criteria that we set, while I'm talking about bulking agents for the most part today, in our broader program, calorie reduction is important to us. So if we can get bulking agents with reduced caloric content, that's desirable. Fiber would be a big positive. Clean, bland flavor and non-cariogenic would be desirable. Okay. So the approach we took is, as I said, using three model systems. We took the two AACC cookie systems, the 1053, which is a wire cut. It's representative of something like a Chips Ahoy type cookie. The 1050, which is a sugar snap type cookie. It's a higher sugar content. And then the soft cake, we're using an internal formula. The ingredients for this first phase of work that we started to look at, we wanted to pick, for the most part, commercial ingredients that we knew either from prior experience, worked in bakery applications to some extent, or that we thought were going to be able to work at least in one of the model systems. So we looked at an inulin, a high molecular weight inulin. Oligofructose, polydextrose, tagatose, even though it's a sugar, because of its low caloric value and some of its other functionalities, we have it in our systems to take a look at. Galactooligosaccharides, resistant maltodextrins, and then we have two experimental ingredients that will be included in the slides. I'm not going to talk too much about them. The other point I want to talk about is the replacement of the sweetness component of sugar. We don't have any data in this first phase on it, but I do want to talk about it because it does present much of the challenge that we're facing as we look at sugar reduction. Okay. So in this initial assessment of bulking agents, we did not replace sweetness. The intent was strictly to establish a baseline, see what happens in each of these model systems when we pull out a pretty good amount of sugar, what happens to the product from a texture standpoint, et cetera, and how does the bulking agent that we're putting in there behave, or how does it differ from a full sugar product. All right. When we did the sweetener assessment, we just selected for each of the model systems the best performing bulking agent so that we could put the bulk back and evaluate the sweetener systems. Okay. So the rest of the slides I'm going to go through, we'll cover each of the model systems, and I'll talk to some of the key findings that we had in this first phase. All right, so this is the 1053 model system. And if you look across, you can see the tagatose sample certainly has more browning. What we noticed was a slight bitter aftertaste in the tagatose. The two experimental ingredients were performed okay. There was really no significant benefit to using them, so at this point, they've dropped out of the study. Okay. And then the next three ingredients were the oligofructose, a high molecular weight inulin, and the galactooligosaccharide. So with the oligofructose, again, as you would expect, we saw more browning. We were starting to pick up a slight bitter aftertaste, and again, this is only at a 25% sugar replacement level. The high molecular weight inulin, somewhat expected, had a pretty negative impact on texture. The cookies, even at this 25% replacement level, were starting to get tough in texture. And then the galactooligosaccharide actually performed quite well. A little bit darker than control. Texture was very good. Flavor was good. Okay. And then the last two, polydextrose and resistant maltodextrin, also performed very well. Polydextrose, we've done a fair amount of work with. We expected at these replacement levels that that it would perform well, and certainly it did. Okay. Now in the 1050 in the sugar snap model, again we saw that tagatose was more browning, bitter aftertaste, but you can already start to see there are even some geometry differences. Less spread in the cookie, higher stack heights. That experimental ingredient, we're still trying to figure out, had pretty big impact on yield, you could see. So the tagatose at this point, with cookie systems, we were stopping to look at least in base cake models. Okay. Oligofructose, again, same deal. More browning, bitter aftertaste. High molecular weight inulin, you can see, again, spread is starting to be impacted, as you would expect, and texture was tough on it, okay? Galactooligosaccharides, again, performed very well in this system. Texture still was very close to control, so far we like what we're seeing with the GOS. Okay. And then polydextrose and resistant maltodextrins, again, behaved pretty well in this system. Looking at it, I probably rank them as GOS, polydextrose, and then the resistant maltodextrins at this point. Okay, and then the last system we looked at was the soft cake system. The soft cake was a little bit more forgiving, I would say. We saw the same basic trend, though. Polydextrose, GOS, and resistant maltodextrins performed pretty much the best at the 25% replacement level. Again, you can see if you look over at the oligofructose and the tagatose samples, a little bit darker. We didn't have the bitter aftertaste issues here that we did in the cookie systems. But the polydextrose and GOS, I'd say, again, would be probably ranked the best. Okay. What I want to do is talk a little bit about the challenges with replacing the sweeteners. Our approach is that we would go after a natural high-potency sweetener system to replace sweetness first. So I don't know if anyone has any experience working with the natural high-potency sweeteners, but what we are finding is what's available to us today is either stevia leaf extract or Lohan Woh extracts. And in both cases, they have a very noticeable delayed onset of sweetness. If you don't have the bitter receptors for stevia, then what our panelists are telling us is they notice a lot more lingering sweet aftertaste. If they do have the bitter receptors, then they're telling us about the slight bitter aftertaste that they're sensing. Both stevia and Lohan have this exhibit this phenomenon called adaptation. So the first taste of it is very sweet. Subsequent tastes, the sweetness is diminished. In these bakery systems, we're seeing that that's even more noticeable. So that's the reason why, if you noticed on the earlier slide with the sweeteners, we're also looking at sucralose and acesulfam-K. And we picked those two high-potency artificial sweeteners because they're bake-stable. We use them in a lot of our systems. They give a very good quality sweetness. The challenge is it's still different. Even at this 25% replacement level, when we use any of the high-potency sweeteners, we don't have the exact profile. And if you remember back, what the criteria we said here is we want to be comparable to control to one of our main brand products. We want to match that quality both in terms of sweetness, texture, et cetera. So those are the kinds of challenges that we're looking at. And that's where I think I would like to open it up, and anyone who can want to ask any questions or has any comments, that'd be great.
Thank you very much, Dominic. So in the Science Cafe format, we open the papers now for questions. And we have Kathy, Eric, John, and Dominic still here. And so if you have questions, please come to the center microphone.
So, distinguished panelists, are you seeing increased consumer requests for reduced sugar or reduced calorie products, either at the consumer level or at the corporate customer level?
Okay, to answer your question, Andy, yes, we've seen that from our customers, and both internal and external. And I talk about internal customers. Our marketing group is looking to promote our ingredients for reduced sugar, reduced calorie options. So we've demonstrated that in a lot of different prototypes that we've shown over the past, you know, different food shows. And again, this is also used in turn to present to customers. So they also use this concepts where we can show how basically, you can make good-tasting reduced sugar or reduced calorie products, you know, based on the ingredients that we have available.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll second that. We also find that people are looking to reduce high fructose corn syrup, although that trend's kind of gone down recently. But people are looking a lot for bulk replacers, bulking agents. And that's an area that we're actively working in.
Okay. The one thing I would add is we have seen, and I don't think this is news to any other consumer products companies, so consumer in testing, consumers will tell us that they want less sugar. One reason why we decided to stick to the criteria of trying to match control as close as we can is when you actually give them products that are either matching sweetness intensity but still different, they're not accepted well. Or if you're actually less than sweetness, they're not accepted well.
Would you second that on price point too?
Yes. Okay. I'd like to meet that brand manager who mentioned the brand manager that first go around was okay with the higher price.
And I would say that although I don't interface with marketing or with the consumer, I do support the Special K brand. And as a weight management brand, yes, we are looking for having lower calorie options for consumers. So want to keep those calories down in those particular foods.
That's a good point, Kathy. And I think thinking of calories, what is the panelist's opinion on consumers' perception of reduced sugar, and then their consumers' thoughts on calories, because reduced sugar is not always reduced calories.
Any comments? This may not answer your question, but I would say that what we're looking at is two things. One, reducing the energy density of the food, so making sure that if you're replacing sugar in order to reduce calories, you're actually using ingredients that would reduce calories. And fiber, for instance, if you put a good source of fiber in a product, that's basically 3 grams. If you're using a fiber that's 2 or 3 calories per gram, you're really not impacting the calories that much. So it really is about a holistic approach to reducing the energy density of the food. And the second is portion size, is helping the consumer to understand the portion size, whether it be in those 100-calorie packs, those kind of things, or whether it be in helping consumers to sort of portion out the appropriate amount of food so that they don't overeat those particular foods.
Something. So I at this point in time I'm supporting businesses in the processed cheese area, and when we reduce calories there, it is not usually called out or trumpeted, but it's very beneficial to reduce energy density, to Kathy's point, and in doing so to maintain flavor and mouthfeel and all those other great attributes fat brings those particular food products.
You know, I'm actually more familiar with soft drinks, and I think back to the mid-calorie products that both Coca-Cola and Pepsi came out with and were big flops because it was neither beast nor fowl. Culturally, people look at low-calorie products as being for women, their diet products, and especially young men reject these things. Something that I've seen recently is the Dr. Pepper 10, where they've reduced the calories. They put a little bit of sugar in it so it has 10 calories per serving. And the advertising campaign is, this is not for girls, this is for boys. So a lot of it is cultural.
Thank you. Any other questions for our panelists? Or any other comments that the panelists want to make?
I think this is sort of a question for Kathy, but everyone chime in. But I wondered if we have enough evidence or if we could generate evidence that would give us the support for an idea that we want to be able to maintain the burning cycle in your body so that food in is actually more efficiently used. And so that if we prescribed, for instance, to consumers and said, if you have this many calories and this much protein and you do it every 2 hours or every 4 hours a day or whatever it is, that you could actually take the average person, this of course wouldn't be for everyone because everybody's all different, but let's say try to find the average person and get them a prescription like that says if you were to follow this, you would maintain the burning. Because I think I see that in the internet in a few places where there company or at least people are trying to make money telling others that that's possible.
I guess I have a couple of comments to that. The first is what we want to do is metabolize foods inefficiently, because if we're inefficient in metabolizing the foods, it'll take more energy to do that. So I think that's part of the benefit of protein over, say, carbohydrates and fats, is carbohydrates and fats are easily metabolized and easily stored, whereas you can't store protein, amino acids, so they have to be used, and so that's what increases the thermic effect of feeding, or that increases the metabolism after you eat those high protein meals. In terms of prescriptions on eating across the day, I don't think we're there yet. It's a great idea, and I know people are making money off of it, but I'm not sure that they necessarily have the data as of yet. I'd say the closest that we have to that is there's some research that speaks to alternate day fasting or alternate day modified fasting, where folks will eat their normal diet every other day and either fast or eat much less on those alternative days. And what that does is basically reduces your calorie intake, and they find that people do not overcompensate the next day. That doesn't necessarily speak to your question, but it does speak to the fact that research is moving in the direction of trying to prescribe sort of eating regimens that might help. The other thing that we do know is eating breakfast in the morning increases your energy expenditure, because you've been fasted. Your energy expenditure is low over that night fast, as long as you're not getting up at 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning and ordering room service. But you keep the fasting keeps your energy expenditure rather low, and once you eat, what that does is it basically fires it up, so that you have that higher energy expenditure, because your body has fuel to keep it moving. So that's I'd say right now as close as we are to finding that sort of relationship. I'd say that that's a great direction to go, and yeah, that would probably be helpful. But again, it's about having those sensitive those methodologies that are sensitive enough to detect those differences, and then to be able to show weight loss over time with those kind of prescriptions.
Thank you for all your comments. They're really all the presentations were really good. I think with regards to like the topic of like sugar reduction, and then the presentation of some bakery applications, and the comments of when we put the sugar reduced versions out there, they don't really sell that well. I think that the consumers have to understand that nothing changes if nothing changes. Okay, if you reduce sugar, it's going to be less sweet. I think the marketing people perhaps could do a better job at advertising and promoting that, and saying maybe it's sweet enough, like the tagline for the presentation today, and just maybe keep approaching it differently. I think that the number of, obviously the statistics, are showing that the number of people that are overweight and obese is such a huge category. It's the majority of the population, that people are going to hit a point. A lot of these people, I think, are young still. It's not just like older adults. And I think as soon as they start hitting diabetes and all the health issues that come with the condition, then I think they might be ready to do some change. I know for myself, it took that to prompt me to go on Weight Watchers and become more aware of what I was eating and where my own diet gradually changed incrementally over time, et cetera. So I think that, if you just get out there and you keep doing the work and keep trying, there might be some losses, and those are probably very painful. But ultimately, I think there's going to have to be a gain. I mean, I go to my Weight Watchers meetings and I buy these mini bars, and they're $6 a box. There's money to be made out there. I mean, I'm willing to buy it. Maybe I have the money, but anyways. But I think that also the portion control and everything else is another angle that can be approached. Maybe not for retail, but certainly for food service. The sky's the limit there. And you can make a lot of money. That's profitable. So thank you.
Are there other comments or questions for the panel or panelists? Other comments you'd like to finish up with? Adjourned. Thank you all for spending the afternoon with us.
Thank you to our speakers today.